Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum program this evening. As many of you know, the Independent Policy Forum is a series of lectures, debates, and seminars that are held by the Institute in the Bay Area, often at our conference center here in Oakland. Our program tonight is entitled Big Brother is Watching. And we're delighted to have the investigative journalist and author James Bamford with us tonight, who will be speaking based on his new book, Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra Secret National Security Agency. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors programs like this, featuring outstanding authors, scholars, policy experts on many issues. I also want to thank Robert Mondavi Winery for kindly donating the wine that many of us have enjoyed this evening. For those of you who are new to the Institute, you can find information in the registration packet that you received when you first came in. Our program is a scholarly public policy research program. We produce many books. We have a quarterly journal called The Independent Review. This is the current issue, which has a cover story on the coming destruction of medical privacy in the United States. And the Institute conducts many conference and media projects based on its work and that which dovetails with interests that we have in our work. For those of you who are joining us on C-SPAN, I invite you to join us and visit our website called independent.org. You'll find further information on research, publications, events, and media programs. For example, our website has a special page on the war on terrorism. You'll find many links on studies and articles and programs pertaining to that obviously immense issue. I also want to point out that with the terrorist crisis and the stampede of special interest politics, there's been a proliferation of government programs, including poor corporate welfare, new forms of protectionism, proposals that clearly are not in keeping with the Bill of Rights. And many of these issues relate to a book by one of our senior fellows, which is called Crisis and Leviathan. It's published by Oxford University Press. Bob Higgs is also the editor of our journal. And if you're interested in getting a greater perspective on what to expect and why things are happening the way they are, I strongly encourage you to take a look at that. As many of you know, this evening, just as opinion polls have been showing that American confidence in government has been returning to pre-9/11 levels, President Bush has outlined his proposal to create a new cabinet-level Department of Homeland Security. This situation reminds me of an old story that some of you may have heard. It's a story about a man who becomes president. And his predecessor, who is showing him around, tells him, this is a really tough job, and there'll be times you will just not know what to do. There are three envelopes in this drawer. When you reach a crisis, open the first one, and we'll help you get through it. So a few months pass. Sure enough, a crisis develops, and there are loud cries for the president's head. He opens the first envelope. It says, blame your predecessor. So he calls a press conference, blames his predecessor for the crisis, and the outcry dies down. A few months later, another crisis erupts, and there is heavy criticism of the president. He opens a second envelope. It says, announce a reorganization. So he calls a press conference, announces a reorganization, and again, the hubbub dies down. Several months later, a new crisis develops. There's a new criticism of the president. He opens a third envelope, and it says, prepare three envelopes. This new Department of Homeland Security, as some of you may know, consists of reassigning a massive series of entrenched intelligence and police bureaucracies and other agencies under a new name with a predictable flag-waving pomp and ceremony. As some of us have mentioned in the past, One would have thought that the Department of Defense was there to protect the homeland. But apparently, this is not the case by the White House's own admission. Instead, funded by a gargantuan budget, the Department of Defense has expanded its preparation to refight the previous wars, namely World War II and the Cold War, even if there is no Nazi, Soviet, or other army to target. The terms military intelligence and government intelligence have long been viewed jokingly as oxymora. But the collapse of the Soviet Union vividly showed the world that government bureaucracy is fundamentally incompetent in assembling and processing information for a complex society. The flexibility and dynamism of competitive markets is able to process a far more immense array of information than can bureaucracy and politics. Yet the most important need for information gathering, that for our own protection, is not only totally controlled by government agencies that operate no more efficiently than Soviet collective farms and factories, but President Bush apparently believes that only by expanding such bureaucracy can we be safer. Bureaucracy has failed. Long live bureaucracy. Clearly, U.S. intelligence agencies themselves failed to warn Americans of the terrorist horrors of 9/11, despite the mega billions in federal spending, an astounding array of high technology gadgets, and global surveillance authority. For months afterward, government officials universally claimed that there was absolutely no indication of any such attack could occur, and there was nothing that could have been done. In fact, FBI Director Robert Mueller claimed that the FBI had, quote, no warning signs, unquote, of any sort of attacks. As a result, the intelligence agencies were rewarded by their failure. Congress rewarded them, and the White House rewarded them with a massive infusion of new government funding, along with unprecedented and new surveillance authority via the Orwellian USA Patriot Act and numerous Justice Department decrees, unrestricted by the inconvenience of the Fourth Amendment, I should add. Apparently, Attorney General John Ashcroft believes that unless the FBI, for example, an agency that has proven to be incompetent on time after time, and occasion after occasion, but the FBI is free to spy on all Americans for any reason whatsoever, essential intelligence information cannot possibly be assembled to prevent future terrorist attacks. However, it was the record of such abuses 30 years ago that resulted in President Gerald Ford implementing guidelines to rein in FBI actions. And even with such policies, of course, since that time, the FBI has been known for internal corruption and many other scandals. Yet within the last few weeks, we have begun to learn that prior to 9/11, government officials did indeed have significant information that may not have indicated what the specification of an attack might be, but strong indication that an attack was imminent, that it might be targeted at certain buildings, it might well involve aircraft, and so on and so forth. According to Richard Clark, White House National Coordinator for Anti-Terrorism, the intelligence community was convinced 10 weeks before 9/11 that an al-Qaeda attack on U.S. soil was imminent. Dissent has since appeared from within the intelligence community. At one news conference, FBI Director Robert Wright stated, quote, "Knowing what I know, I can confidently say that until the investigative responsibilities for terrorism are transferred from the FBI, I will not feel safe. The FBI has proven for the past decade it cannot identify and prevent acts of terrorism against the United States and its citizens at home and abroad," unquote. Calling the Ashcroft, Mueller, Bush actions to expand the power of intelligence agency a, quote, fraud, unquote, columnist William Safar of the New York Times has recently noted that, quote, "They have the power to collect intelligence, but lack the intellect to analyze the data the agencies collected," unquote. He goes on to say that, quote, "Thus we see the seizure of new powers of surveillance as a smokescreen to hide the failure to use old power, the old power of the FBI," unquote. Safar then continues with the following very interesting quote. Quote, "Consider the new reach of federal power," and this relates to our topic tonight. "The income tax return you provided your mortgage lender, your academic scores and personal ratings, credit card purchases and easy pass movements, your political and charitable contributions, charge account at your pharmacist and insurance records, your subscription to non-mainstream publications like The Nation or Human Events, every visit to every website and comment to every chat room, and every book or movie you bought or even considered on Amazon.com, all newly combined with the tickets, arrests, press clips, full field investigations, and raw allegations of angry neighbors or rejected lovers that flow into the FBI, unquote. But the problem goes even deeper. The problem is not just one of incompetence or rival agencies. The more telling aspects of the terrorist attacks is that bin Laden's network of terrorists was recruited, created, funded, armed, and trained by the CIA itself in the early 1980s in Afghanistan, and the CIA and other agencies have continued to work to fund Islamic fundamentalist groups in Central Asia, including Afghanistan, up until the present. There's far more that could be said about all this. But I think the important issue is that we have a lot of confusion and a lot of issues which are at stake. Largely because of the work of James Bamford, the public knows that the ultra-secret National Security Agency, the largest and most powerful of all espionage organizations in the United States, operates a global system of spy satellites. But few know of its roles in the Cold War, the hunt for bin Laden, and Echelon, the worldwide NSA spying system that monitors millions of innocent people. No outsider knows more about the NSA than James Bamford, who has been researching the issue for many years. In fact, his previous book, Puzzle Palace, was published before most members of Congress even knew about the NSA. Mr. Bamford is the author of Body of Secrets and Puzzle Palace, as I mentioned. He's been a Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight. He's written cover stories for the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post Magazine, the LA Times Magazine. He's currently distinguished visiting faculty at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. I'm very pleased to introduce James Bamford.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it, and it's a real honor to speak before you today and follow such luminaries as Gore Vidal and so forth. So it's a real honor to be here today. I appreciate it. David mentioned that even some members of Congress didn't know about NSA. When the Puzzle Palace came out in 1982, I had to do a book tour, and I had to go on one of the shows as a public broadcasting program. I can't remember the name of it right now, but it was based in Dennis Horley's show. I think it still has his show on TV. And I was going to go there to talk about the NSA, and one of the other people that was going to be on the show was going to be Senator Bill Bradley from New Jersey. So we got in the same car, rode over to the studio. He was going to talk about the economy, and I was going to talk about NSA. So in the car, he said, "What's your book about?" And I said, "It's about NSA, the National Security Agency." And he said, "What's that?" So I proceeded for the rest of the car ride to explain what the largest intelligence agency was to the senator. When we got on the show, the first question the host asked was, "How secret is NSA?" And I just couldn't resist it. And I said, "Even Senator Bradley said he never heard of it." So he took a separate car back to the hotel after that. And the next day, his aide called me up and said that was really below the belt. And I said, "I'm just telling the truth. He's one of 100 people that really should know how the government works." And I said, if I wanted to hit him below the belt, I would have said he probably confused it with the NBA. Which I didn't. Not only Congress, but when the book came out, it got picked by Book of the Month Club as a selection. So like every author, you get the New York Times Book Review, look at your little jacket on the back with all the famous authors, Stephen King and all that. And I just couldn't believe it when I saw mine because it said The Puzzle Palace, a report on NASA, America's most secret agency. And the ad agency thought I had made a mistake on my own book, so they voluntarily changed NSA to NASA. I mean, the only advantage was I probably sold copies to a few astronauts that might not have ordinarily bought it. And even in bookstores, I would go in there, and they would have I go to where the book was supposed to be, and it won't be there, and I go up to the desk and ask about it, and they, a lot of times they say, yes, we have 5 copies. It's back in the puzzle section. So this time I changed it to Body of Secrets, but I think it was Barnes & Noble. One of those chains began putting a discount sticker on it, and they covered up the "of," so it says Body Secrets. And so people are thinking I'm writing about the G-spot or something like that. But anyway, the NSA is an extremely secret agency. When I wrote The Puzzle Palace, it was the very first book ever written about NSA. And I never thought I'd have to write a second one, but after I wrote Puzzle Palace, nobody came along and followed in my footsteps. So I ended up writing Body of Secrets about 20 years later, and which is only the second book written on NSA. So I sort of have a monopoly on that topic at this point. The government was not very happy that I wrote The Puzzle Palace, or was not very happy that I was writing The Puzzle Palace. And they twice threatened me with prosecution, even though I never worked for NSA, I never signed any clearance forms with NSA or anything else. They just didn't like anybody writing on NSA. I mean, the old saying at NSA is that the NSA stands for no such agency, and internally the joke is it stands for never say anything. And then when the Puzzle Palace came out, they said the joke now is it stands for not secret anymore. But it was still very secret. I didn't, I barely scratched the surface. So they also were unhappy that I got documents out of a particular library down at the George C. Marshall Research Library down in Lexington, Virginia. It's on the campus of the Virginia Military Institute. So they went down to the library after the book came out, and they actually raided the library, and they began pulling off things from the shelves and ordering the archivists to lock them in vaults and so forth. This is after the book's already come out. I mean, I didn't really understand the logic of that. I mean, if you do it before the the horse is out of the barn, I could see. But as a result of that, the government's actions, the library, as well as the American Civil Liberties Union, the American Library Association, the American Historical Association, they all sued NSA over that, saying you shouldn't be able to go into a private library and pull out non-classified private documents. These were not government documents. These were private letters by one of the individuals that formerly worked for NSA, one of the founders of NSA, William F. Friedman. So the history of writing on NSA is not a history of ease. You have to fight the government every way. Another problem with trying to write on it is the Freedom of Information Act, which is usually a very important tool. But NSA is the only agency that's excluded from the Freedom of Information Act. Little thing called Public Law 8636, subsection 6, which I know by heart. It says, Congress shall make no law requiring NSA to divulge any information about its organization, function, structure, salary, personnel, or any other information. So I had to find sort of loopholes in these, that Public Law 8636, and I was successful in fighting the government over a number of documents I requested. I ended up getting more than 5,000 pages worth. So the history is just a lot of hard work in trying to get anything out of this agency. When I wrote this new book, I approached the agency, and again, I got the same response. You know, we're not going to help you. We're not going to give you any interviews or allow you in the agency or blah, blah, blah. But then a new director came along and saw the logic in allowing at least a book to be written about it. I had written The Puzzle Palace, and the world did not come to an end after that. As a matter of fact, the government ended up using the book as a textbook in the Defense Intelligence College. So. And it was really only the NSA that was going crazy. The State Department actually invited me over to give an address to the senior officials of the State Department, a thing called the Secretary of State's Open Forum, and they had me for lunch in the Secretary's dining room afterwards. At the same time, the NSA is coming after me. With this book, though, it was different. The new director came along, saw the value of having at least a... another book, that last one was 20 years ago when The Puzzle Palace came out. And one of the key reasons was Hollywood was creating this image of NSA as an agency full of assassins. An enemy of the state, for example, the director of operations or the deputy director, I think it was, assassinated a congressman because of a bill he didn't like. So NSA thought that, you know, if there was a impressionable teenagers or whatever see this movie, and they are interested in NSA, it might be useful to have a book that's at least accurate in the library and the bookstores. So they did agree to help me, and they let me in the door and gave me tours through the agency, interviews with senior officials, and they didn't help me with the documents. But once again, I found loopholes, and I got another a couple thousand pages worth of documents. At the same time, the agency, when the book came out, instead of threatening me with prosecution, this time they had a book signing for me, which was very strange. I think they were, originally they wanted access to the book. They wanted to have access to the book before it was published so they could see what, you know, what was in it and what was good or not. And I just said, you know, having done this for 25 years, I'm not going to start now giving censorship rights to government agencies. So eventually they backed off, and they gave me the access anyway, and I never ended up giving them any advance notice, copy of the book. They saw the book when everybody else got it in the bookstore. So the book's untainted by NSA's own censorship. Nevertheless, the agency, they realize the value of it, and I think they've appreciated the book. I think it came as a shock to everybody that they actually had a book signing. It actually went on for 4 hours up there. And originally, when the Puzzle Palace came out, they had basically told all the employees they couldn't buy it and couldn't discuss it. So it was very interesting during the book signing and seeing all these employees walk up with copies of their Puzzle Palace also. But I'd like to get into a little bit about what the agency is about, how it works, some of the issues revolving around September 11th and so forth. I'll just give a brief overview of what NSA is. Basically, as David said, it's the largest intelligence agency in the world, the most secret intelligence agency in the world. Compare it to the CIA. The CIA was formed in 1947 by the National Security Act. They had hearings, there was debate, there was nothing secret about the creation of the CIA. The NSA, however, was formed in 1952 by President Truman, and it was formed by a top-secret memorandum. And the contents of that memorandum has been secret for many years. It was just declassified in the last few years. And that memorandum laid out the parameters of this very, very secret agency. Even the name was secret. Its very existence was secret. Congress was not told about it. There were eventually about two people in Congress that were told about it, and that was it. Eventually, the name got out because of a spy scandal and so forth. But since that time, NSA has remained extremely secret. Even today, when you hear about all these things happening with the intelligence community, you almost never read about the NSA. You read about CIA, FBI, all the other agencies, but NSA virtually never appears in the press, or very rarely appears in the press. I did, however, do a piece for the Washington Post last week in their Outlook section, a long piece on NSA's responsibility during the September 11th attacks. The agency basically grew out of World War II. World War II had the greatest successes in breaking the German and Japanese codes, and the German Enigma machine and the Japanese Purple Code. And the U.S. was in a bad position when the war was coming to an end. We're about to go to this Cold War involving Russia. The problem was Russia was our ally during World War II, so we'd never paid virtually any attention to Russian codes, with one small exception known as Venona. But there was very little attention paid to Russian code breaking. So at the end of the war, the U.S. and Britain decided they'd create this new, very secret organization known as TICOM, which even today is technically secret. The NSA still has the secrecy wraps on TICOM for another 5 years, but I managed to get the documents dealing with TICOM. And what it was is basically the U.S. and Britain wanted to getting to Germany as the war was coming to an end, and captured German code breakers and code makers and a lot of their documents and machines. Because they wanted to find out two things. They wanted to find out whether the United States was vulnerable, because if they had broken U.S. codes. And number two, they wanted to find out ways that the Germans used to break Russian codes. So they went to Bletchley Park, where all the code breakers were outside of London. It's sort of like a monastery. And these are people that spent the entire war sitting behind desks reading these intercepts. And a lot of them were not in very good shape in the first place. They were former college professors and so forth. And then somebody told him, you're going to have to show up at 0500 or whatever and get into a plane and start parachute jumping. And they just couldn't believe it. But they were actually trying to train these code breakers to drop into the front line as the war was coming to an end and use them to help capture these German code breakers. Well, after the first two or three jumps, they decided to give up that idea. So they transported all the code breakers to the front line in trucks. And it worked well. The U.S. found out that the Germans never did break codes, U.S. codes, very, very much. Didn't do very well at it. And they also found that the Russians, that the Germans actually had done an enormous job on breaking Russian codes. And the Germans led the German prisoners led the U.S. and Britain to the location where they buried this enormous code-breaking machine. And once the U.S. and Britain dug it up, they were able to immediately begin intercepting and breaking Russian codes. And it was an enormous machine, about, I think it was 40 tons, something like that. So the U.S. was able to go seamlessly from breaking German-Japanese codes to breaking the German code. And that lasted until 1948, when there was a spy in NSA's predecessor and gave the secret away, and then Russia changed all its codes. And at NSA, it was long known as Black Friday at that point. During the 1950s, NSA poured a lot of money into the computer industry. It basically primed the pump for what is today America's enormous computer industry, because if you're breaking codes, the way to do it is to get faster and more powerful computers. About this time, the NSA came up with another problem, and that was during World War II, there was censorship. So the Western Union and all these other communications companies had to turn over their messages to the government code breakers and intercept people. But once the war came to an end, they ended censorship, and as a result, NSA was without the raw data for its interception and code breaking to a large degree. So they began working out a secret deal with Western Union and these other companies. And it lasted for more than three decades, basically. And this was a very secret operation, totally illegal. NSA worked out this agreement with Western Union and the other companies, where Western Union would turn over every telegram going through that company during the entire day. At the end of the day, they would turn it over to NSA, and NSA would get copies of them. And this is totally without any kind of a warrant. Normally, if FBI or DEA or one of the other agencies wanted to look at one message, one telegram, they would have to get a warrant from an impartial judge.